To receive weekly mailings of Rabbi Mansour's tapes or to sponsor a tape, call 718-375-1023. To hear Rabbi Mansour's daily halakha or to search the Rabbi's database of halakhot, visit www.dailyhalakha.com. That's DAILYHALACHA.com. And now, Rav Mansour.
Baruchim Abayim, ladies. We're studying today Parashat Chaye Sara. The parasha where we begin and we learn about the death of Sara Imenu and the life that she lived of 127 years. Hachamim tell us that when the Torah tells us Vayiyu Hayeh Sarah, it was the days of Sarah, Me'ashana, 100 years, Esrim Shana, 20 years, Veshev Ashanim, and 7 years. It's a funny way of telling us that she lived 127 years. It splits it up in three separate departments. She lived 100 years, she lived 20 years, she lived 7 years. The Torah doesn't waste any words. It could have just said she lived 127 years. Why the breakdown? So the Hachamim tell us, and that she brings it down right in the beginning, that it's telling us that when she was 100, she was like 20. And when she was 20, she was like 7. It's comparing the different stages in Sarah's life. What does it mean when she was 100, she was like 20? So they say at the old age of 100, she had the sins of a 20-year-old. And at the age of 20, she had the beauty of a 7-year-old. Now, I always understood the first part of this thought, that they're saying that when Sarah was an old lady, 100 years old, she was still pure. She was still like she's 20 years old before she started. She didn't have sins. She was clean. But I never understood what it means when it says, and at the age of 20, she was as pretty, she was as beautiful as she was when she was 7. Common sense and fact tells us that a lady at the age of 20 is more beautiful than a girl at the age of 7. Even though all children are cute and all the children are nice, but the fact is, a 20-year-old lady is more beautiful. So what is it? At the age of 20, she had the beauty of a 7-year-old. If you tell me the opposite, that's something to talk about. A 7-year-old girl has the beauty of a 20-year-old. This is something. But the opposite, at 20, she was like 7. So the explanation the rabbis tell us, I think, is a very important lesson, especially for the mothers to learn this. Achamim are not telling us how pretty she was. That's not something the Torah is so interested in telling us, how pretty Sarah Imen was. It's telling us her attitude. Who's more vain? A 7-year-old or a 20-year-old? Obviously a 20-year-old. Well, a child 7 years old doesn't care too much what it's wearing, even though our children do care what they're wearing today, even at 3 years old. But normally they go out, they run around, they're not too careful if their hair is brushed or the hair is not brushed. They don't care if they have a little peanut butter and jelly on their face when they go outside. They play in the mud. They play in the dirt. Children are less into the look, the way they look, than a 20-year-old. 20-year-old, before she leaves the house, she stands in front of the mirror. No, I don't like how it looks. Change her clothes again. Look at it this way. Comb my hair, brush hair, makeup, etc. As we get older, we become more vain. So the Hakamim are telling us the greatness of Sarah. At the height of her beauty, at 20 years old, she was like a 7-year-old. Which means, yes, she was the prettiest lady in the world. But that didn't weigh too much on Sarah. She had the innocence of a 7-year-old. She didn't have the vanity that she was supposed to have at 20. She had the simplicity of a 7-year-old. That wasn't a priority in her life. She didn't care too much. She didn't put a focus on the external beauty. That's a very important lesson to know. Yes, the Imahot were beautiful women. There's no question about it. The Gemara says if you compare the Imahot, our matriarchs, to human beings, it's like comparing a human being to a monkey. That's how pretty they were. They were beyond beauty. But it's important also to know that they didn't focus on that. The beauty that they had was a gift from Borei Olam, it was a beracha, but you shouldn't think that they spent their whole lives trying to maintain the beauty and work on the beauty. And on the contrary, Sadat 20 was like a 7-year-old. Yeah, who cares how she, not who cares, not the God forbid they were sloppy, but it wasn't a main focus of Sadat Menu at that age. Unfortunately today in community, not only in our community, but all over, we're finding not a new problem, but an old problem that recurs by the girls especially, the young girls in the community, that are suffering all sorts of eating disorders. Eating disorders that are beyond comprehension, whether it's anorexia, whether it's bulimia, and all these things. And of course, I'm not going to oversimplify a complicated problem. It's not such an easy thing where you can say 5 seconds, this is the reason why it happens, and next. There's books written, like encyclopedias, to explain where these disorders come from. And it's not because of one reason. It's because of a host of reasons. But one reason is for certain, that when parents put such an emphasis on beauty and on look and on the image and on weight and on food and on exercise, when that pressure is given to a child at a young age, so this is a very great weight for a child to handle, and therefore, again, plus the pressure of a community that has this pressure of exercise craze and diet craze. And again, we're not saying that you should go eat now and become overweight and let yourself go. Of course, a parent has to guide his children what to eat, what not, but in moderation. But everything has to be in normalcy, where the children are not crushed by such pressure, which causes them now that they're worried, that they have to compete, that they're scared if they eat something, that they're not going to look good, and God forbid they're causing themselves to vomit the food that they eat in order that they don't get... This is mentally ruining our children for stupidity, for stupidity. Who cares? We see our children eating, it's supposed to tell them, sahtan, enjoy it, eat more. They never make such a big issue about, unless it's a problem, unless we're talking about overweight, where it's an issue. But our children, Baruch Hashem, they're not, most of them are not having this problem of obesity. They're eating a little more, a little less. But to put such an emphasis on the exercise and the look, and to even make compliments, a parent or a mother will tell a child that you don't look good, you're gaining weight, the dress doesn't look good on you. You have to be careful when you say these things. We say it, we forget about it a minute later. We're just saying it as a parent. But the child, that comment, you know, sticks in the brain 30 years later. The child says, oh, my mother, I remember, told me I didn't look good in this dress over here. And it's always nervous now what to eat, what not to eat. The Torah specifically tell us, Sarah, the most beautiful of women. There's not a woman in the world today that's as pretty as Sarah Emenu. But the Torah goes out of its way to say, trust me, to her children, not that she had daughters, but to her students, because she had many students, that wasn't her focus. She had the naivete of a 7-year-old when it came to her beauty. She didn't put that as a focus in her life. A very important lesson that we have to impart to our children. Torah tells us how after she died, Avraham Avinu now had the task of burying his wife, which is obviously never an easy task. Hachamim do tell us that he negotiated with a group of men. The leader of that group was a fellow called Ephron. Avraham was negotiating with him to buy a very famous property that many of us have visited, none other than the Me'arat HaMachpelah, the great grave site in Hebron, where Adam and Hava are buried, where Avraham and Sarah were eventually buried, and Yitzhak and his wife Rivka, and Yaakov, and Leah. One of the holiest sites in the world, Me'arat HaMachpelah, was purchased in this week's Perasha from Ephron to Avraham. Hachamim tell us that this was actually, according to some opinions, at least one of the tests of Avraham. We know Avraham endured 10 tests in his life. Akedat Yitzchak was one of them. Being thrown into the furnace of Nimrod not to worship idolatry was one of them. Leaving his father's house was one of them. This over here, burying his wife, was a test to Avraham. And the question is, what was the test? We read, who did the land of Israel belong to? Avraham Avinu. God gave the land to Avraham. So technically, he just has to go to Hebron, bury his wife. It's his. He owns it. He has the deed. Hashem promised him the land. And now these fellows come, Ephron and his cohorts, and they start to tell Avraham, listen, we can't sell it to you. And they start negotiating with him. And they start haggling back and forth. At the end of the day, Avraham has to pay an exorbitant amount for that piece of real estate. A piece of real estate that was his. It's like somebody coming to you, living in your house, and somebody coming to you and saying, okay, pay me. Pay you for what? For the house. What do you mean? It's my house. I'm living here. I have the deed. I have the mortgage. And the greatness of Avraham Avinu was, how is he going to react in the negotiations? Because Hachamim tell us, if you want to judge a person's character, there's three moments you could judge a person. If you want to know everything about a person, you could judge him at the time that he's drinking. That's bekoso. When a person drinks alcohol, person goes to drink. Look at the difference between when the rabbis drink on Purim and they get a little high, and you hear words of Torah come out of their mouth, and you hear words of Musar, and you hear words of inspiration. But God forbid, if you give somebody to drink that has in him a lot of not nice things, it'll all come out as a result of it. So if you want to know who somebody is, give him a couple of drinks, and then you see his true behavior. This is a litmus test, the barometer of character. The second thing Hachamim tell us is his pocket. People are very kind, are very warm, are very sensitive, but all of a sudden get to their pocket, start dealing with their money, and all of a sudden you see a different monster. Now ready, it's mine in court. You owe me the money, you didn't pay me the money, I'm going to get you. What happened? You're such a decent person. I can't believe you turned into a monster of a human being. So touch a person's pocket, and already you'll be able to tell the character of this person. And the last thing Achamim tell us is, in the time of anger, look at a person, how he manages his anger. When things are fine and everything's good, you don't know what's going on with the guy. But all of a sudden, step on his toe, get him angry, and all of a sudden you see a character unleash out of the person, and now you're ready to say, oh, this is exactly what the person is. The greatness of our Hachamim, they were able to control themselves under all circumstances. Even under the greatest of pressures, they were able to maintain equilibrium. They didn't lose themselves. They were able to control themselves. That's the greatest test of character. They tell stories. There was a great rabbi called the Saba from Slobodka. And he lost a child, God forbid, on Chol HaMoed Sukkot. And Halakha says that, God forbid, when somebody dies on Chol HaMoed, you don't start sitting until after the holiday. So it's a very difficult thing to have a mourning period that you're not really allowed to mourn yet. And the Saba from Slobodka, the students say how they saw him coming from the hospital on the holiday with such self-control, because he knows that he's not supposed to cry on the holiday, fighting with his emotions, even though the pressure on him was very great. You can imagine what it is. And then as he was walking, he could not control himself, and he started to cry for a minute, and then he snapped his fingers as if he forgot. We're not supposed to cry. And he stops himself immediately. And then he went through the rest of Sukkot. Simchat Torah, they said he was dancing in the Midrash more than the other people. He was the one that was motivating everybody for the Simchat Torah. The holiday ended, and the rabbi sat on the floor and started to cry uncontrollably, and they could not console him. Now, this is a measure of character that is able to hold his emotions and to control himself, superhuman, to go above and beyond what is called. This is already the greatest test of character. Avraham Avinu, there were some rabbis when they used to want to accept a student to the yeshiva. So there's different methods of how to test a child to accept him to the yeshiva. So one rabbi had a method. he wouldn't test him in the Gemara. He knows the Gemara, he's prepared for, he studied it, he knows it. He would invite the boy to the yeshiva, to the lunchroom, to have lunch. And he'd watch him as he was eating. Because at the time when people eat, it's also a pressure time. People are hungry, people are nervous. The Gemara says, Sha'at achila, sha'at milchama. That the time of eating is the time of war. You have to be careful. When people sit down to eat, they want their food. Don't start making trouble with them. Let them eat, let them relax, and then start getting involved with them. So therefore, you have hungry boys in the yeshiva, they come down to eat, and you see them, one guy pushing, one guy's, no, I want that piece, no, it's mine, I got it first. And you see the way they eat. So the rabbi would monitor them and watch them. He'd see the boy that would stand online, even though he's starving, but he still has the respect, he still doesn't push. He takes the food out, he well, gets up to wash, he has the patience for an extra minute there. He sits down, he opens his napkin. He eats normally, makes the beracha. That would be the test. Because when life is normal, everybody's able to play a charade. But when all of a sudden the curveball comes, now things get difficult. Now all of a sudden something happens out of the ordinary. Now they're, well, how do you react? If you react in a normal, calm manner, that already tells that that's your character. Because now already you can't sketch anyone. Now already you're in control of it. Avraham Avinu, he just came back from Akedat Yitzhak. You could imagine what that was. He almost had to murder his own son. Could you imagine the white hairs that would put on a parent? Granted, Yitzhak was saved, but it still is it's an insurmountable thing to ask your father to slaughter his son. Yeah, he came out alive, but the pressure that he was under, and now he comes home, and the first thing he sees is his wife dead. And they tell him, yeah, you know how she died? She thought you killed your son. So as if they're blaming it on Avraham. Of course, Avraham knows that that's a false way to look at death. Avraham understands that a person dies when he's supposed to die. And death is from Borei Olam. And therefore, Avraham does not let the Satan, who's trying to make Avraham feel guilty, that is, if he had a hand in the death of his wife, Avraham believes that when a person is supposed to die, that's ordained from heaven, and therefore there's nothing you could do. If she wouldn't have died from Akedah, she would have died from a different cause. When the time is up, the time, and that's a very important lesson. Many times children, they always feel, God forbid, if they lost a parent or a loved one, that maybe we could have done more. You know, maybe if we would have been a little extra, we could have extended the life. Here, the Torah is teaching you, when the time comes, unless you did something reckless, unless you went and you pulled out a plug of a machine, or you went and, God forbid, you cut air supply, which none of us would ever think of doing, all of us are normal people. We visit, we do, we get the best doctors, we try. But at the end of the day, when the time comes, the time comes. So therefore, Abraham doesn't feel any guilt. Abraham tells the Satan, you think you're going to make me feel better? I killed your wife? I didn't kill my wife. I listened to the word of God. I did Akedah. She died because she was supposed to die at the time. But don't think it's a pressure for Abraham to see his wife dead. Now he wants to bury her. So he figures this is the easy part. I'll just take my wife, go to my plot, put her in the coffin, and finish. All of a sudden, there's people standing at the plot. Where are you going? This is not yours. This belongs to us. Now Avraham has to negotiate. And now you see him under pressure. Let's say the pasuk would have said, and Avraham got nervous, and he started yelling at Ephron, who do you think you are? I'm reading that pasuk. I say, Avraham has a right to scream. Hazir, he had a hard day. You know, we scream and get nervous for much less things. If one thing doesn't go our way, already we have an excuse to be rude to somebody, to snub somebody, not to say hello, because, and we understand it. Oh, he's having a hard day, she's having a hard day. Okay, we understand it. Did anybody in the world have a hard day like Avraham Avinu? If anybody had an excuse to be rude, to be short, to be a little sarcastic, to be a little tough, it was Avraham. And what is he doing throughout the negotiations? The Torah says he's bowing to them, which was a proper way to greet people. He's talking to them with the utmost speech of gentleman, nice way. He doesn't demand anything, and he pays full price. Hachamim tell us that was the greatest test of Avraham Avinu. Because now you see the way he acts under pressure. Even Akedat Yitzhak, when God told him to sacrifice his son, he was told to it, he did it, he went. Here, this is daily life. Now this test came from nowhere. He was just all of a sudden coming home thinking that it's going to go smooth and there was a glitch. Something went wrong. Now, but I was a total control. He says, because something is going wrong, I'm not going to lose all my character. And this is why the test of Abraham is the greatest. And this is why this test is the greatest. He was tested with his money. He paid an exorbitant amount. And he was tested in his patience not to get nervous and not to lose his derech eretz. But in the negotiations, the rabbis, the Torah tells us, Ephron was willing at one point to give it to Abraham for free. Abraham refuses that. There's no way, I'm not taking it for free. I want to pay for it. So the stipler rabbi asks, why not take it for free? It is yours. He is offering it, so take it. Why spend $250,000 on something you don't have to, Abraham? Why didn't he take it? So he gives different reasons. He says one reason is because the Tzaddikim never liked to take money from people, because those people will go around saying, you see all the wealth of Abraham? He got it from me. And therefore the Tzaddik always wants to get his money from Borei Olam, not from having to get it from some goy that's going to go around parade and say, you see Abraham Avinu's wealth? Of course. What are you talking about? I did him a big favor. I gave him this for nothing over here. I saved him all sorts of money. So therefore he doesn't want to have any people talking as such. But there's a more important reason. Nothing in life is for free. Abraham knows the rule that if somebody gives you something for free, now you're indebted to that person forever. Even if he gave you something small, but now you owe him forever, you can never repay him back because he was the first one to give you something for free. So now you never feel as if you paid him back. And therefore, Abraham does not want to be beholden to anybody. One of the rabbis from Brisk used to say, the cheapest way to buy something is paying for it, is with money. Money's cheap. Once you pay for it, finish. I'm off. I don't owe you nothing. I don't have to do your favor in return. Once you take something for free, now that's it. You're married to the person. Now, forever. It's on your head. I did you a favor. So Abraham does not be fair. If I take this now, who knows? Ephron now is going to hold this on my head forever. And who knows what he's going to ask me to do or not that. I'm going to feel obligated to do for him. And I don't want to be married to Ephron. So Abraham pays $250,000, but in his mind, this is the cheap way out. Let me get rid of him. It's only money. And now finished. I don't have to see Ephron again. The Torah then goes on to tell us how Abraham Avinu was going to look for a wife for his son Yitzhak. And the Torah elaborates on this 67 Pisukim, talking about how Abraham went and employed his servant Eliezer to be the shadchan, to be the matchmaker, for him to go and try to find a wife that would be suitable for his son. There's no perashah in the Torah that is more elaborate than this perashah. There's no perek, 67 pesukim, all talking about the marriage. And if this perek has so much space and takes up so much space in the Torah, that teaches us the importance of marrying off our children and marrying off people in general. It shows you how great the mitzvah is. You know, Shabbat. How great is Shabbat in our religion? Maybe there's 3 or 4 pesukim in the whole Torah that talk about Shabbat. But on the subject of getting married, you have 67 pesukim. It's not normal. Eating kosher. How important is it? I want pasuk. Eat kosher. Don't eat not kosher. But when it comes to getting married and trying to make a match, the Torah is elaborating, and we always said there's not an extra letter in the Torah. If the Torah is elaborating, that means it's showing you this is 67 pesukim more important than all the other things that we only mentioned in one word. And therefore it's incumbent not only for us to try to marry off our children, but to involve ourselves, not an easy thing, but to involve ourselves with marrying off people in general. It's not such an easy thing to be a matchmaker or a shadchan, but to even just to keep in mind names in order to try to set people. It shows you the value the Torah puts on it. But one thing which is interesting, Avraham, before he lets Eliezer go to find the candidate, he makes Eliezer swear to him. Swear to me that you're not going to mess this up. Swear to me you're not going to go bring a girl from the land of Canaan. I want you to go to my birthplace. The rabbis ask a few questions here. What was so bad about the girls of Canaan? And what was so good about the girls from Avraham's birthplace? They all worshipped idolatry. So is this just Avraham's prejudice? I want somebody from my hometown? This is bad and this is worse. It's not like he said, listen, I don't want you to go to Canaan. I want you to go to Borough Park or go to Williamsburg. Then we understand this is bad, this is better. But you're telling me, I don't want you to go to, Las Vegas, but I want you to go to, another city that's New York City, another place which is same thing. What are you talking about? So the explanation they say is like this. You're right, they both worshipped Avodah Zarah. But the girls from Canaan had bad character. And the girls of his birthplace had good character. Philosophy, you could change. But character, you can't change. The very poor lesson. Which means, Avraham's thinking, if we get a girl with a good personality, and a good way, and a good demeanor, and proper behavior, so she has bad thinking, she'll come to our house, we'll teach her the right way, Hashem, the mitzvot, and everything. But if the foundation is good in midot, then already the brain changes. But if they're decrepit in their personality, then already you can't change these people. This is the worst midah. Great lesson for parents that are looking to marry off their children, what the priority of the Torah is. Torah tells you the number one thing on the list that you have to look for in a potential son-in-law or daughter-in-law is character. Now, of course, the character has to be followed by religiosity. But character comes first, because religiosity can change. She's that already, the boy can become a little more religious, can become a little more observant, the girl. But if the midot are bad, if the character is bad, then it doesn't start. You see, Avraham would rather the good midot over the other things. But I want to understand today, why does he make Eliezer swear to him? This makes him swear, don't mess this up, do this right. He doesn't trust Eliezer. Eliezer, the Torah tells us, worked for Avraham Avinu for 70 years. So it's not like he just met him. He knows who he is. And not only did he work for him, but he trusted him when it came to everything else. Avraham Avinu was a wealthy man. He was so wealthy, the Torah tells us, he employed his own personal army. How many people do you know today? Bill Gates doesn't have his own army. Man's worth $48 billion, doesn't have his own army. Avraham had his own army, 318 soldiers on call. Now, if he had 318 soldiers, it means they're married and they have children. So his staff, just in his house, he has 5,000 people working for him. Who has 5,000 people in their staff at home? Avraham Avinu was a tycoon, he was a wealthy man, and who managed the whole estate? Eliezer. He has his keys, he's in control of everything. So you'd say he trusts him, no? I mean, this is trusting with all that money, you have to have children. When it comes to marrying his, being the matchmaker, he doesn't swear to me. I swear to me, don't trust me. Yeah, I have every vault number, I have every combination, I sign every check. I have to, if you don't trust me, it's too late already. Then forget about it. And the explanation the rabbis say, Avraham Avinu was teaching us a great lesson. And they base it on a story. There was a rabbi called Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta once went to a hotel. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta was a great rabbi. So the hotel manager, who was Jewish, sees him and says, he didn't know who the rabbi was. But you could tell he's religious, he has a beard, this. So he sees him, he says, Rabbi, do me a favor. Do you know how to slaughter animals? He says, why do you ask? He says, because I need to slaughter an animal to prepare the dinner for the hotel. And usually I have to take it to the slaughterhouse, which is far away. I figured you're a religious guy. Maybe you could save me the trip and slaughter it for me over here. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanta says, I'm sorry, but I'm not really an expert at slaughtering animals. So, okay, thank you. 5 minutes later, the rabbi goes to the hotel manager. Could you lend me 10 rubles? So the hotel manager says, I don't know who you are. I'll lend you 10 rubles. I don't know if you're honest, not honest. I don't know if you're a crook. How can I lend you 10 rubles? I never met you. He says, that's very strange. A minute ago, you were going to trust me to slaughter animals for you, for kashrut. You had no idea who I am. When it came to religious issues, you trusted me. Oh, when it came to money, oh, I have to know who you are. I have to do a report on you. I need guarantees. And the rabbi was trying to say, that's how we are. When it comes to religious things, since they're less important to us than material things, so we're more trusting. We walk into a restaurant, we don't know if it's kosher. Not to ask one guy, it's kosher? Yeah, it's kosher. Okay, he said it's kosher. Finish, we can eat. Now, if that same guy would come to you and say, can I borrow $10? Who's the guy? I never saw this guy before. But you just trust him to eat if it's kosher or not. But you won't lend him $5, $10? Because why? Because kashrut is not as important to us as money. Money, we need to know. Kashrut, okay, so even if we make a mistake, so what? That's where we asked. we could exempt ourselves. So the Torah is coming to tell us that was not Avraham Avinu. He had the exact opposite approach. When it came to his money, here, take all my keys, take the vault numbers, take the checkbook, what's the worst thing? You're going to steal something? So you stole some of my money. So it's not the biggest problem in Avraham Avinu's life, that somebody might have taken some of his money. But now when it comes to marrying off his children is a religious issue. This is the issue now over here of building the future of the Jewish nation. Now Avraham Avinu tells Eliezer, swear to me that you're not going to mess this up. This is already a priority to Avraham. Just because he trusts him for the money, that doesn't mean anything. Money didn't mean anything to Avraham Avinu. He had it all. But just like the beauty of Sarah wasn't her priority, so the money of Abraham, big deal, take the keys. But marrying off my children? I don't trust anybody for this. This is a religious issue. And therefore his priorities were in line. He knew exactly what to make an issue of and when not to make it. He knew when to trust and when not to trust. At least we should be consistent. Not that we should put one above that. At least we should be consistent in our material, the way we deal with it, and our religion, the way we deal with it. Hakamim tell us the story of the Hafetz Chaim when he once was visited by a wealthy man, and Hafetz Chaim lived very modestly. So the fellow said, Rabbi, I'm willing to, you know, to build you a mansion. This is not a way for you to live. Look at you. So the Hafetz Chaim, in his humility, says, you're here on business? Yes. Where are you staying? So we're staying in such a hotel. And how big is your hotel room? Says, nothing. It's one room. Do you have a kitchen? No, there's no kitchen. You don't have a kitchen? Rabbi, I'm on a business trip for a couple of weeks. I eat in the can and So the Hafetz Chaim smiled and he said, I'm also on a trip. He said, this over here is not my main... I'm going to have a mansion, he told him. I'm an Olam Haba, trust me, I'm going to have what I'm supposed to have. But here, I don't want to get too comfortable because it's not my priority. That was a great story for the Hafetz Chaim. But that's also supposed to teach us to try to put the things in the proper the proper perspective that they're supposed to be in. Eliezer goes on this mission, and he does some strange things on the way. Strange things that it's worth it to point out, because Eliezer obviously was a smart man. If Abraham trusted him to go do this, yeah, albeit he made him swear, but at the end of the day, he trusted him. So we have to discuss Eliezer's mode of operation here. The first thing he does is when he gets to the well, he prays. Please, God, let me be successful. Let the girl that's supposed to be for Yitzhak, let her come to the well. Give me a sign that I'll know it's her. Why did he pray? They say, wait, why did he pray? Wait, the rabbi, you always have to pray. Avraham already blessed him when he left. You'll be successful. Avraham didn't tell him when you get to the well, open up a Tehillim book and start reading. That wasn't part of Avraham. Avraham gave him directions. Do this, do this. The praying, that was Eliezer's idea. Which is, another guy could have said, listen, Avraham told me to go. He gave me his beracha. I finished the great rabbi of the generation. I'm just going to go do it. I got to have to pray after he prayed. So why did he pray at the well? Number two, he sees a girl that's very generous. She's giving water to him, water to the camels, something beautiful. Immediately, Eliezer takes out the jewelry from his pocket, he takes out the sweaty, he takes out the things that he brought, and he starts to give it to her. Take this, bangles, and nose rings, and all sorts of trinkets, expensive trinkets. And then he asks her, who are you? And she says, oh, I'm from this family. And it is, okay, good, that's the right family. Now, isn't it backwards? Shouldn't he ask the girl before he commits and starts giving her engagement rings? He should say, hold it, which family are you from? Let's say she says, oh, I'm from Canaan. Oh, that's it. Now what? You gave her the neck. There's no backseat. You can't ask for it. You gave a girl a nose ring. Now you can ask her for a back after you gave it to her. So he's doing things opposite. He should first ask, who are you? And then give. And then Rivka takes Eliezer to her house. And Lavan and Betuel. Betuel is Rivka's father. Lavan is a brother. They see Eliezer. They bring him in the house. They sit. So they say, okay, listen. We understand that you're here for a match. You're trying to make a match over here. But first, let's sit down to eat. And the answer is, no, I will not eat until we finish this deal. Where are you rushing, Eliezer? Where are you here already? You found her in record time. How long does it take to marry up a child? Here Eliezer goes, the first G comes to the well, that's the one, brings it to the house. So eat something first. No, I will not eat until we close the deal. Then they make the deal. So the Lavan and Betuel say, fine, now that we close the deal, let Rivka stay for another couple of days. Maybe let her stay for 10 days, a month. And then you'll take her. Let her 1 month. Let her stay a little longer. No. If you don't give it to me now, I'm leaving. We have to take her. Why was Eliezer doing these strange things? One answer answers all these questions. The answer is Eliezer also had a daughter. And Hachamim tell us that Eliezer actually offered his daughter to Avraham. He said, listen, I'm working here for 70 years. I'm your student. We're together. My daughter was raised in your house, so you know we are. So what do we even have to go shopping around anyway? Let's make the bazra immediately and close the deal. For whatever reason, Avraham declines. I don't want to go into the reason now, but I want to explain to you that it's not so simple to build a nation. As great as Eliezer is, and as great as his daughter is, which is undeniable, but to build a nation at the foundation level, it has to be perfect. It has to be exactly what Abraham knows it has to be, otherwise the foundation is going to be a little off. As great as Eliezer is, he comes from Canaan. His descendants were from Canaan. although he was able to maybe better himself, but it's in the genes, it's in the blood, and the Ezer's daughter, for anybody in the world, would be the greatest catch in history. But for Abraham's son, you need something that has many conditions. So the Eliezer is rejected. So Eliezer, if he's a normal human being, he can go on this trip and come back a couple of days later and tell Abraham, you know, Abraham, I tried, but there's no girls out there. There's no girl. Don't we hear that today? There's no girls, there's no boys. I looked, I went, there's nothing there, there's nothing going on. And now Avraham's going to say what maybe? All right, you know what? There's no girls. Is your daughter still available? Yeah, she's available. Eliezer now is biased. Because he has his daughter, so that's very hard for him to be objective. It's very hard for him to do this job the right way, knowing that his daughter is sitting home and she's a potential candidate. So look at the greatness of Eliezer. He gets to the well. Abraham didn't tell him to pray, but he prays. You know what he's praying? Please God, let me not mess this up because of my prejudice. Let me not mess this up because of my bias. Abraham sent me on a mission over here. I know I have a daughter at home, but give me the vision that I can still see clear that I'm not going to try to mess it up in order to do good for my daughter, because that would be wrong. So he's praying to God, give me success that I can overcome my own personal things. That's why Abraham didn't tell him to pray for that. That's the Eliezer's issue. And then the first girl that he sees already that's a potential hit, what does he do? Right away he gives her the rings. Because the quicker he gets it done, so now he's not going to go back to his daughter. Now you're right, there's a chance that that could be from the wrong family. Now he's stuck. Now he has to get more rings out of his own money to give it to the real girl. But he's willing to take a risk to give it to immediately, just so it's locked up, so he won't come back to his daughter. Now he gets to the house. They tell him, eat something. I can't eat. Where are you rushing, Eliezer? I'm rushing. I gotta lock this up. I gotta bring her home. Give it so I don't get, because the Yetzirah can creep in at any moment and say, you know what, Eliezer? Don't be silly. Your daughter's better than this girl over here. You know what? Leave her. So Eliezer doesn't want to let even a crack of opportunity for the Yetzirah to jeopardize it. So now what happens? They say, oh, let us stay for a month or two. Month or two, Shemai. And that month, what's going to happen to Eliezer? His brain's going to play tricks on him. Your daughter. So therefore, Eliezer's greatness is, and he works at great speed in order to show us that he kept his objectivity. You know what teaches us? This was the servant of Avraham Avinu. Look how honest he was. Look how right he was. Look how fair he was. If that was the servant of Avraham, what do you think Abraham was? If this was only the Eved, could you imagine what the master was? And that's why if we sit here for 1,000 years, we'll never be able to fathom who Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov were in their truest measure. Yeah, we could tell a little tidbit, little story, little anecdote about them, but to know the weight of their character, it's impossible for us to ever fathom. It's impossible for us to figure out their servants, how great they were. Who has such intellectual honesty that's able to put their own things on the side and not get jaundiced or tainted or blinded from a personal interest? That was why Eliezer acted in the way he did. Last but not least, as we explained, the main trait that Eliezer was looking for was midot, was good character. But he was also looking for good character, chesed, benevolence, kindness. But he was also looking kindness with the brain. He was also looking that you're marrying Yitzhak. Yitzhak's an awesome figure. She has to have a secher. She has to be just be smart. So how did he test her? So listen to this test. He gets to the well and he says like this. I'm going to ask the girl for a drink of water. She's going to give me the water. I'm going to drink. I'm not going to drink everything. I'm going to leave some leftovers. I want to see what she does with those leftovers. Because if she takes the leftovers home, not for us. Because I'm a stranger. Could you now give a stranger to drink from your bucket? And now what? You're going to take that water home? Maybe the guy has the cooties. Maybe he has some type of disease. Who knows what he has? They're going to go, here's extra water. God forbid, you're putting them in danger. So he's watching. Is she going to take them home? If she does, she's out. X. Another option she could do is she could pour it out on the floor. But that's Ibe. He just gave somebody to drink, and now what he tried to show him, oh, you have disease, I don't want to drink your water. So that's also not the right. So in Eliezer's mind, the right move to get out of this dilemma, not to embarrass him, is to offer to the camels. That's a nice way out of it. Oh, there's leftover water. Oh, Mr. Eliezer, please let me give you camels to drink. So that's it's a diplomatic way out of the issue over there. Give the camels. So she looks like she's doing Eliezer to the camels, and she's not embarrassing, and she gets rid of the water. The Rivka not only meets expectations, but exceeded expectations. Why? Because Rivka says to herself, if I'm going to offer the camels to drink, Eliezer might think, yeah, this is a nice way to get rid of the water by giving it to the camels. So what does she say? Not only am I going to give the camels to drink this leftovers, but I'm going to give them more water until they're finished drinking. What does that show? That the reason why I'm giving the camels is because I want to give the camels to drink, not because I want to get rid of the leftovers. If I only wanted to get rid of the leftovers, once they finish drinking, the leftovers finish. She says, no, I'm going to give the camels to drink until they're finished, as much as they want. Eliezer says, this is a smart lady. She has chesed, but her chesed is also, it's measured. She knows exactly the how and the when and the what, and therefore he says, this is the one for Yitzhak. He brings her home. Yitzhak was praying Mincha at that time. And immediately it says when Rivka saw Yitzhak, she covers herself up with the veil in modesty. Yitzhak was an awesome figure. She gets off the donkey, and Sarah brings her into her mother's, Sarah's tent. Sarah passed away, but now she's walking in. And immediately when she walks in, all the miracles that took place in Sarah's tent when she was alive came back. The candles in Sarah's tent used to be lit from Friday to Friday. She used to light candles Erev Shabbat like the ladies light. It'd last a whole week. If our candles last to the next morning, it's a great thing, but it's only because we put a lot of oil. But in Sarah's tent, it was the miracle of Hanukkah every single week. They lit one way and it lasted the whole week. There was a beracha in the dough. The dough stayed fresh and hot all week. And there was a cloud of glory on top of the tent. When the Rivka walked in, these three things started to come back. Yitzhak understood that this girl over here is the right girl. The chapter ends, and he took her for a wife. I heard from one of the rabbis this week an interesting insight. So I'm going overtime, and I'll let you go right after this. 67 Pesukim talk about the courtship, the shadchan, the investigations, the deals, the back and forth, but the marriage, three words. And Yitzhak married Rivka, and he took her as a wife. It's lopsided. And what's more important, the engagement or the wedding? Obviously, the wedding is the highlight. There, the Torah should go speak and tell us all the details. But the Torah is telling us the details of everything that happened before the wedding. Why? So I heard the rabbi answer very sharp. Because if all the preparations are made before the wedding, then already the wedding is, that's a small thing. The main preparation is what happens before the wedding. The wedding is the easy thing. It's not a mitzvah to rush the preparation. The Torah discusses how Avraham prepared, how Eliezer went, how he discussed, how he analyzed. If a parent is diligent before the wedding comes and spends hours and phone calls and asking who the boy is, who the family is, and meeting him and letting the couple go out for a while until they get to know him, if the foundation is good before marriage, the Torah doesn't even have to tell you. They got married. Finished. This is easy. Because already we spent 66 pesukim talking about the preparation. But heaven forbid, if we don't spend 66 pesukim before the couple gets married, then the marriage is a long story. Then, God forbid, the marriage has all problems. Parents are not supposed to wake up the day after the wedding to start to tend to these issues. They're supposed to wake up to these issues when their children are still young, before they go out, not when they bring home somebody where it's too late now. Children, the parents have to be like Avraham Avinu. He's calling the shots. It wasn't Yitzhak brought home a girl. Now it's too late already. Now already Avraham has to react. Avraham Avinu was in control of it before he went out with a girl. I'm going to pick, I'm going to see, I'm going to analyze. You see here also, it's a lesson to children, how they have to trust their parents when it comes to these issues. Yitzhak could have told his father, Yitzhak was 40 years old, by the way, he wasn't a baby. Yitzhak could tell his father, listen, you're going to tell me who to marry? I'm 40 years old, I can do what I can marry whoever I want. As great as Yitzhak was, he subjugated himself. He said, my father knows better. My mother knows better. And the truth of the matter is that is the truth when it comes to these things. Children think they know better when it comes to marriage. But they're being guided by passion. They're being guided by the wrong things, by honor, by the puppy love, as they call it. But the parents are being guided by the objectivity, what they see, or the experience that they know. And therefore the children have to know. If Yitzhak listened to Avraham when it came to getting married, then every child should take the advice of his parents very seriously before they decide who they're going to marry. May you all be blessed that your children should get married and find their nasib at the right time and the zechut of this. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen, amen. Thank you.